passion for God and compassion for our neighbor, reaching our region and beyond with the life-changing message of Jesus Christ. This is Crosswinds Church. And now, here's Pastor Kurt Truxas.
On that day that you call Palm Sunday, Jesus entered into Jerusalem. The people loved him. They wanted him to be their king. They wanted him to wear a crown. But how quickly things change, don't they? By the end of the week, they hated him. They wanted him dead. They wanted him wearing a cross. My story, it goes in the opposite direction. Beginning of the week, I mocked Jesus. But after I saw how Jesus died, at the end of the week, I worshiped him. My name is Longinus. I'm the centurion that was in charge of crucifying Jesus. And today, they've asked me to come and share my story. As a centurion, I'm in charge of 100 Roman soldiers. I'm the highest ranking Roman soldier that is on the ground working with the men. And as part of my job is to keep the peace in the city of Jerusalem. And keeping the peace doesn't always mean being at peace. In fact, many times it meant that we were in charge of the executions, the crucifixions. We eliminated the murderers, the thugs, and the rebels. I was in charge of hundreds of crucifixions. But Jesus' crucifixion, well, that was different. Life-changingly different. Let me tell you why. At first, it seemed like any other Passover. The tension between the Jews and the Romans, as so many Jews had come into town for Passover, was thick. You could almost cut it with a knife. But this Passover was different, because there was a new player in the game, a young rabbi who had come into town. He was a carpenter turned teacher turned rabbi that the people had fallen in love with. They hung on his every word. And the week before, when he had come into town, the people had thrown him a green carpet welcome. They had sung his praises, singing, "Hosanna in the highest." And the Jewish leaders had watched. And they had turned green. Green with envy. They were determined to find a way to eliminate this new rival to their power and control. Fortunately for them, an opportunity soon came their way. One of Jesus' own inner core, one of his 12 disciples, a man named Judas, proved to be a turncoat. He approached them and offered to turn Jesus over for a mere 30 pieces of silver. Turning your own rabbi in for a mere 30 pieces? He must not have respected him much. Judas agreed to look for an opportunity to turn him over, but it didn't seem like they would be able to find one, because every day the people were surrounding Jesus, listening to his every word from his teachings, and to arrest Jesus at those times would produce a riot since he was so popular. But finally, the opportunity came on a Thursday night, late after the meal. Most of the people were in bed. And Jesus had chosen to leave the inner parts of the city and go to the Mount of Olives to be sort of alone and to get away with his disciples. Judas saw his chance. It is then that he went and he told the Jewish leaders. Now, I wasn't involved in that arrest. That arrest actually took place with the temple guard. And I heard that when they came to arrest him, they came dressed and prepared for war. Knives and clubs and swords, all to arrest this gentle yet popular teacher with only 12 disciples. Well, 11 without Judas. all they could officially do was bring him in for questioning. First, they brought him into the house of Annas, who is the father-in-law of the high priest, and they questioned him there. Then later during the night, they brought him to Caiaphas, who was the high priest, and they questioned him there. And they brought forward many false accusations and false witnesses, but a man like Jesus, of such pristine and pure character, none of their lies or their framing worked, because nothing stuck or rang true, except for this one accusation, that he had claimed to be the very Son of God. That sent them into a rage, almost like a demonic rage, because the next day when he was transferred to our custody, I saw what they had done to them that night. When he came into our custody, I saw that his hair was matted because they had been spitting all over his face. His face was red. He had been struck across the face and slapped multiple times. His nose was out of joint and to the side, and there was blood crusted in his beard, having been running down his nose and from his lips. His eyes were swollen shut. He was disfigured, almost unrecognizable. Later I heard they had played a game with him that night. They blindfolded him and took free shots on his face repeatedly, one after the other, and they would say, "Prophesy! Prophesy, teacher! Who hit you?" While they could barely get away with abusing him, the one thing they knew they could not do without bringing down the very wrath of Rome was taking his life. So as morning rolled around, they schemed up a plan to have Rome and to have Pilate take his life for them. Early in the morning, they brought him to Pilate. And I was there at the time when we transferred Jesus into the control of my soldiers from the temple guard. And we exchanged the Jewish shackles on his wrists and on his ankles for Roman shackles on his wrists and ankles. And that's when I saw how they had abused him. And I wondered, these supposedly godly men, why had they treated this gentle yet popular teacher this way? What had he done? What were the accusations? Well, Pilate came out of his headquarters, and the Jews came before him, and they leveled the accusations before him. They said, "This man Jesus, he stirs up the people. He tells them not to pay their taxes, and he's claiming to be Christ, a king." No, I knew right away that this wasn't true. I was in charge of making sure we kept the peace on the streets in Jerusalem, and my men were on the streets every day, and we had heard about Jesus, but never that he told people not to pay their taxes. Never was he encouraging rebellion. What we had heard was that miraculous things had happened through him. People who were blind could see. People who were lame, he had healed and could walk. We had even heard that one time he had fed a crowd of thousands, all from a little boy's lunch. And recently, we had heard that there was even a dead man who had come back to life. Never had we heard him encouraging people not to pay their taxes. These were trumped up charges, false lies. Thankfully, Pilate, our wise ruler, he could see right through what they were trying to do. But one thing he did latch on to. He turned to Jesus and he said, "So is it true? Are you a king? Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus had a very interesting response. He said, "You have said it is so." He didn't deny it. Pilate immediately knew what was happening. It was out of envy the Jews had delivered him over. Pilate would have none of this. He said, "I find him innocent." We weren't prepared for what would happen next. the Jews and the crowd before us started rioting, throwing dirt in the air, starting to break things. And my soldiers, they lowered their spears. We were on the edge of a riot. This is something that could not happen in Jerusalem at this time. There were thousands upon thousands of Jews that were on edge, feeling their nationalistic zeal, and our soldiers were there. And if the killing began, who knew when it would stop? So quickly, Pilate said, "Wait, wait. Jesus, doesn't he originally hail from Galilee? Galilee is Herod's district. Herod is in town for Passover. I send him to Herod." And he quickly avoided the riot and disaster. My soldiers and I, we led him to Herod. His house wasn't far away where he was staying. And Herod was happy to see him. He had heard so much about Jesus. He was looking forward to seeing Jesus perform a miracle so he could tell his friends and his guests, "Look, Jesus has performed a miracle for me too." And Herod and his soldiers questioned him, but Jesus remained silent, saying nothing. Finally, Herod grew frustrated. He said, "I find no guilt in him," since he sent him back to Pilate. We brought him back to Pilate, and Pilate stood before the Jewish people again. He says, I have found Jesus innocent and of not doing anything deserving death. Herod has found Jesus innocent and not doing anything deserving death. I will punish him and set him free. Surely that would placate these angry nationalistic Jews. But it didn't. Once again, they began to go into a furor out of anger and frustration about Jesus. And my soldiers, they lowered their spears. And once again, we were on the edge of a riot. And Pilate said, "Wait, wait." He thought of another angle to maybe set Jesus free. The problem was these Jewish leaders who had infiltrated the crowd and were telling people lies and half-truths about Jesus and were controlling the crowd. They were the source of the problem. Maybe if Pilate could go around them. You see, it's the tradition that every Passover, as a goodwill gesture, the Romans, we would release one of our Jewish prisoners and give them back to the people. Now, at that time, there was only one Jewish prisoner that was in the dungeon. It was a man named Barabbas, a notorious prisoner. He was a murderer, cold-blooded, an insurrectionist, hated by Jews and Romans alike. Surely, Pilate thought, if I give them the choice between Barabbas, who everyone hates, and Jesus, whom they were worshiping only days earlier, wouldn't they choose Jesus if I just appealed to the people and I could override these Jewish leaders? So Pilate told them, "It's my custom to release one of your prisoners. Which one would you have? Barabbas, the murderer, or Jesus?" Pilate had that small smile on his face, thinking he had finally beat the Jews. But it wasn't true. They had already expected this to happen, and they had infiltrated the crowds and told the crowds what to say when this happened. We heard someone scream, "Give us Barabbas!" And then another, "Give us Barabbas!" And more in the crowd, "Give us Barabbas! Give you Barabbas?" Pilate released Barabbas. He took Jesus away, and he had him flogged. He had his clothes stripped off, and he was punished. He was whipped across his back, and he was beaten. Then he was taken into the Roman army barracks, where the battalion of soldiers were. Hundreds of soldiers. The soldiers already had deep-seated hatred for the Jews and all the things that they had done, and they vented all of their hatred on Jesus. They put a scarlet robe on him. They twisted together a crown of thorns off the date palm tree, long thorns, inches, and then they pressed it into his skull, producing searing pain. They put a reed in his hand, and then they would bow down before him and mock him and worship him. They would take the reed out of his hand and strike it across his face. They would take their hands and they would beat him and hit him again and again. Now, after having been beat the night before in the face by the Jewish temple guard, and then having been whipped by the Roman soldiers, and having the crown of thorns pressed on his head, and having been pummeled and hit by a battalion of soldiers, when Pilate brought Jesus back out to the people, he was a sorry sight, quivering on his own two legs, barely able to walk. And Pilate turned to the people and he said, "Behold the man." As if to say, "This is the man that you hate, that you fear? Jesus?" But having given him a beating, the Jews still did not relent. They began crying out, "Crucify him! Crucify him! Crucify him!" And the crowd began to become restless. My soldiers once again lowered the spears, and we were on the edge of another riot. Finally, Pilate, out of frustration, said, "Okay, Longinus, take him away and have him crucified." And Pilate washed his hands of the situation. That day, the wheels of justice would turn, but they were crooked wheels. Because Pilate, who had tried four times to release him, knew, and I knew as well, that Jesus was innocent. But this is sometimes what happens. We took Jesus away to crucify him. And as part of the way we do this as Romans, what we do before we crucify someone is we scourge them. You need to understand that in the way the Romans did this, we had three levels of whipping. There was the first level of whipping, which was just regular whips, which was exceedingly painful, but there was a top level of whipping that we administered to someone before we crucified them. It was done with something called a cat of nine tails. It was a whip with nine strands in it that had metal balls on the strands that when ripped across the back would tenderize the flesh. It had metal hooks in it that would sink into the flesh, and the soldiers would tear it off, ripping out chunks of flesh, strips of flesh. After the lashes, the muscles of a man's back were exposed. The bones of his back were seen. His organs were often able to be seen right through what was left of his flesh. This is what we did to Jesus. But right away, I knew Jesus was different. Because over the years, we have learned that torture brings out the true heart of a man. As we've scourged and then crucified criminals over the years, we've seen the evil, the darkness, and the hatred of their heart that comes out through their mouth during these times. All swearing and cussing and hatred, the vilest forms we could ever conceive of. But for Jesus, none of that came out. Yes, he was in pain, and yes, he called out, and his flesh quivered out of the sheer agony as we brought him to the very edge of death through pain itself. But no hatred, no condemnation, no evil, no swearing. It was like his heart was completely pure. We took the crossbeam, which is a piece of rough-hewn wood weighing about 100 pounds, and we put it on his shoulders, and we would tie the crossbeam with strips of rope around the upper arm, making it impossible for those who were being crucified to drop it. Then we would chain together the crossbeams if we had multiple victims, and this time we had three. Jesus was one of those three. And we would lead them through the streets. Typically, what we would do is we'd have four soldiers assigned to each victim. three that would be around him to protect him and to make sure he followed along, and one that carried the placard. The placard was a piece of wood that we had painted white, and on it was the charges against those who would die. They stood in front of the condemned. That way, when we led the condemned through the streets to their crucifixion, people would see what they had done and what would happen to them, and they would learn never to rebel. Usually the placard said murder or thief or treason. Jesus was different. It said King of the Jews. Never before had I crucified someone with those charges, that he was the Jews' king. As we worked our way through the city streets, a crowd quickly gathered as I rode behind the group on my horse. It was a feast day, so the shops were closed. People were looking for things to do, and they gathered around. And also, since it was a feast day, the ban on travel was off, and travelers were pouring into the city to be there for Passover. Our plans were to go to the north of the city, to go just outside the city gates, to the hill called Golgotha. And there, on top of the hill, we would crucify these three criminals. And those entering and leaving the city from the north would be able to see them, and it would discourage rioting and rebellion during the rest of the Passover. And after we worked our way through the city and we got outside the gates, right before we climbed the hill, Jesus collapsed. He could go no further. It made sense why the other two that would be crucified that day had been scourged like Jesus. Jesus had also been whipped prior to that. Jesus had also been beaten by a battalion of Roman soldiers. The night before, Jesus had been struck and beaten by the temple guard. There was nothing left for him to give. So those who would be crucified could continue. We needed somebody to carry that crossbeam that was chained in the group. And it wasn't going to be a Roman, I'll tell you that. So I told my soldiers, grab one of these Jews coming into the city for Passover. And they grabbed a man named Simon from the city of Cyrene. And they had him carry the crossbeam while the rest of the soldiers helped Jesus to the top of the hill. There, out of pity, they offered him wine mixed with myrrh. Now, you may not understand what that is, but wine mixed with myrrh is sort of like a sedative to try and dull the pain. And sometimes we offer it to those out of an act of compassion. But Jesus, when he tasted it and realized what it was, he spit it out. It was as if he wanted to endure the full extent of the sufferings that were in front of him. The Roman soldiers, they strapped the crossbeam to the main beam with ropes. Then they put ropes around Jesus' hands, and they put his torn open back on the rough-hewn wood. They laid him down. One soldier would grab the ropes on one side of his hand. The other soldier grabbed the rope on the other side of his hand, and they put their foot each on the edge of the crossbeam, and they pulled as hard as they could, stretching his arms completely far apart as possible. A third soldier took and held down his hand. The fourth took out the metal spike in the mallet and pounded it through his wrist. You could never forget the sheer agony and the sound of metal hitting metal, the sound of flesh tearing, bones crushing. It's an eerie, agonizing sound. And I told you, when men are tortured, you find out what's in their hearts. And at those moments when we are pounding the spikes through the wrists and through the feet, we often hear the most evil and vile things. And did Jesus cry out? Yes, but there was nothing evil. No hatred. No malice towards any of us. In fact, Jesus said this. He said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Made that sick feeling in my stomach. I knew Jesus was innocent. He didn't deserve any of this. And there was no evil either in him or that he had done. And now Jesus was praying. He was praying for me and for my soldiers as we tortured him and killed him. I can tell you what, Jesus was the most God-like man I had ever seen. Those Jewish leaders that were supposedly godly, they were the most godless men I had ever seen. And Jesus, as we finished nailing him to the cross and we put him up and we put the thieves up next to him, while one thief mocked him, the other thief turned to him in looking for mercy. And Jesus turned back. He said, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." And looking in front of him, the crowd that was gathered there, he saw his own mother standing next to one of his disciples. And he had trusted his own mother into the hands of one of his disciples. Now that may not sound significant to you, but you need to understand, having done this for years, when men are being tortured and they're being crucified, all they can think about is themselves. All they can think about is the agony and the pain that they are enduring. But Jesus wasn't thinking about the agony he was enduring. He was praying for me and for my soldiers. He was reaching out in love to the thief dying next to him. He was caring for his own mother. Jesus, I told you, his crucifixion was like nothing like any other man that we had killed. Now, it was about noon. Noon, and it was the heat of the noonday sun. It was blisteringly hot, and Jesus was on the cross. And then things changed. They became eerily weird, because all of a sudden, darkness began covering the land. Pitch black darkness at noon. Some people thought it was an eclipse, but it couldn't be an eclipse, because eclipses don't happen during Passover. This was a supernatural darkness. And I realized what was happening. It was like there was a connection between this godly man Jesus and creation itself, as if creation was going into mourning and sadness as they saw him suffer on that cross. And this pitch black, unexplainable darkness that covered the entire land lasted for 3 hours, from noon until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then Jesus, around three, he cried out, "My God, my God, why? Why have you forsaken me?" One of my men ran and grabbed a sponge and put it on a stick and dipped it in some of the cheap wine that the soldiers had been drinking, and they held it up to his mouth because he was so dry he could barely speak. Everyone wanted to hear whatever Jesus would say. And then he said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. It is finished." And he hung his head and he gave up his spirit. None of us were prepared for what would happen next. We had already had this supernatural darkness for the last 3 hours. And all of a sudden, when he died, a massive earthquake hit the city. Everything began shaking. Boulders of huge size began splitting in half. Graves that were in the graveyard, graves opened up. Dead people came alive and started walking around. It was like when death swallowed Jesus. It ripped. It leaked. Nothing like this had ever happened before. And at this point, I was filled with terror. My men were filled with terror. Who had we killed? This innocent, this man who was so godlike, this man truly was nothing other than the Son of God. and I told my men, truly this man was the Son of God. Later that day, orders came in from Pilate. The Jews had apparently asked that the legs on those who were being crucified be broken to hasten their death. We broke the legs of the first criminal, and we broke the legs of the second criminal, but when we came to Jesus, he was already dead, as we know. But because we had to be sure, one of my soldiers took a spear and he thrust it into his side, into his heart sack, piercing his heart, sending out a sudden flow of blood and water, showing that the blood and serum had already separated. Indeed, Jesus was dead. And before evening, Pilate called me. Apparently, a man named Joseph of Arimathea, a righteous man, a Jew, but a Jew that had not taken part in the condemnation of Jesus. He was requesting Jesus' body. And Pilate asked, is it true? Has Jesus died already? And I certified it. Indeed, Jesus is dead. We gave Joseph of Arimathea the body. And he brought with him a friend, Nicodemus, who was also a follower of Jesus. They took the body and they wrapped it in strips of cloth and spices, and they laid it in Joseph of Arimathea's own tomb, which was nearby, because the next day was the Sabbath. That night I laid in bed and I couldn't sleep. What had we done? We had killed an innocent man, a man who was not just innocent, but a man who undoubtedly was the very Son of God. What would become of me? Is there any hope? Is there any forgiveness? Is there any future for me and my men? I couldn't sleep Friday. I couldn't sleep Saturday. But strange things happened on Sunday. You see, the Jews had asked Pilate for a detachment of soldiers from my barracks to guard the tomb of Jesus because they were afraid that somebody would steal the body. I could tell you, those who were his followers, they wouldn't steal the body. They were running. They were scared. But Pilate had amused them and given them the soldiers anyway. And in the barracks, I heard that something strange had happened. Apparently, an angel had come down from heaven and rolled away the stone. And these battle-hardened men had stood there in fear and trembling. And the angel had said, look and see. He is not here. He is risen. He's alive. The strips of cloth and the spices were there, but Jesus was gone. And then the reports began coming in around town that Jesus was alive and that Jesus had actually met with his disciples. Jesus was not some kind of a phantom or a ghost, but he had actually eaten with his disciples and swallowed food. His disciples had actually touched him. That self-same body that was dead was now alive. And it wasn't just a few people around town. It was all over town. And the claims that he were alive came not just from Jerusalem, but even up from Galilee, which was his hometown. And he appeared to groups of not just two, three, or a dozen, but even up to groups of 500 people at one time. Indeed, Jesus had risen from the dead. Jesus was now alive. I went and I talked to his followers. I said, what does this mean? And they explained to me what had happened. That Jesus had not resisted being put to death, because it was God's, the Father's plan to have him put to death. And that it was 3 hours of darkness when he was on the cross that God the Father had poured out on his own Son all of his just wrath against your sin and against my sin had been poured out on his own Son. That Jesus has died in our place for our sins. And that when Jesus died and he went into when he died and he rose again. It's like he busted through death from the inside out, conquering it and becoming victor over it. And that Jesus had conquered Satan. He had conquered sin. He had conquered death. And now Jesus was restored to the rightful ruler of all creation. And then they told me this, that anyone who asks Jesus to be the ruler in their life and repents of their sins become participants with Jesus. And their sins are forgiven by what Jesus has done. And their life will live eternally in the very presence of God. Because Jesus has risen from the dead, and so will they. That's what I wanted. That's what I needed. Forgiveness for my sins, and to be with this man who was, without question, the very Son of God. And that day, I became a Christian. Now, I told you earlier that if you could just walk in my shoes, if you could have experienced what I experienced, seen what I saw, that you too could no doubt come to the very same conclusion, that indeed, Jesus wasn't just any man, but Jesus was the very Son of God. My hope is that by telling my story, that you too realize he is the Son of God, and that you too become a Christian and place your hope and your faith in him. Thank you for letting me share my story.
This has been a presentation of Crosswinds Church. More of Pastor Kurt's sermons can be found online at crosswinds.tv. Thanks for being with us, and may God continue to enrich your life.